TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. There was a sense of family in the audience in September 2012 at Berkeley City College when the new book, The General's Son, was presented. The Israeli general, Matti Pellet, is the father in this title. He was part of the general staff during the Six-Day War in 1967. Israel then conquered the West Bank, Gaza, the Golan Heights, and Sinai, setting the stage for the untenable situation the Palestinians face today. Many in the audience that night remembered Matti Pellet, the former general. Later in his life, he became an advocate for the Palestinians and spoke about his peace plan in Berkeley and many other places around the world. However, on stage that night was the general's son, Mikko Pellet. He continues and moves forward his father's work. Born into a privileged family, he could have had a shining career in the Israeli military or in politics. But the influences of his father, as well as his mother and sister, inspired him to take a different path. Eventually, he chose to visit the very territories his father had helped to conquer. On his journeys of an Israeli in Palestine, he formed friendships in the West Bank, reconsidered his own schooling, and did much original research to rewrite, with authority, the history he was taught growing up in Israel. His book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, was published by Just World Books in 2012. The poet Alice Walker wrote the foreword, and she was in the audience that night. Alice Walker said that this book is the most hopeful on the topic of Israel-Palestine. Here is The General's Son, Mikko Pellet.
And thank you all for being here today. It's interesting, I was just handed a flyer here that talks about advertises as a talk by my father here at Berkeley on February the 10th, 1983. And I understand quite a few of you were there, so thank you for bringing this to my attention, and thank you for your continued efforts and your continued work in regards to the issue of Palestine. I also want to point out and express my gratitude to Alice Walker, who's here, who's lended her very important voice to the Palestinian issue, both in her blog and being in the flotilla and with the Russell Tribunal, and was extremely generous in writing the foreword to my book. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you. I'd like to begin my talks with a disclaimer. And the disclaimer is this. If anybody here came expecting to hear a balanced presentation, they're going to be sorely disappointed. And the reason for that is, number one, I don't believe a balanced presentation on this issue is possible. If anybody says that their presentation is balanced, they're either misleading themselves or their audiences. I mean, everybody knows. Everybody's got a strong opinion on this issue. Everybody has strong feelings, strong emotions on this issue. For me, it's a deeply personal issue, so there's no way it could be balanced. The other reason that it can't be balanced is that it's not a balanced situation. We don't have a balanced story here. A lot of times we hear people compare it to, two kids that maybe just can't get along on the playground. They need to be allowed to sort it out. I think a better analogy would be a lunatic child with a loaded gun running around in the schoolyard shooting everyone. And so somebody's got to intervene and somebody's got to do something about it. So like I said, balanced this is not, but I hope you will bear with me if you find some of the things that I say difficult to accept and difficult to hear. I think in order to do this justice, to do the Israeli-Palestinian conflict justice, we have to look at the past, we have to dispel some of the myths, and we have to take into consideration that there's a huge double standard when talking about this issue here in America and in the West in general. There's this myth that says that this is a conflict that's been going on for generations, for hundreds or thousands of years, and that there's really no end in sight because it's been going on forever. Well, this is not true. This is a political conflict, and I think if we were to put to pinpoint a time where we can really start talking about the conflict as it is today, that would be November 29th, 1947, when the United Nations decided to partition Palestine. It's also important to remember that at that time, there were two communities living kind of on parallel existence. There was a Jewish community that numbered about 500,000 people, and there was a Palestinian community that numbered about 1.5 million people. Yet somehow, when the United Nations decided on the partition, they decided to give the larger portion of the country to the smaller community, and the smaller portion to the larger community. Who in their right mind thought this would work, I don't know. But I'd venture to say that nobody expected it to work. And then the story that we hear, the myth that we hear about this, is that immediately after the Jewish community finally got that kind of recognition, where the United Nations recognized that a part of historical Israel should be dedicated to a Jewish state, the Arabs attacked with the intent of destroying that small Jewish community. And somehow, miraculously, because they were smart and because they were dedicated and because they held the moral high ground, they prevailed and they won. And of course, the Arabs, you know, all disappeared. But when we look at the period between the end of 1947 and the end of 1948, and what actually took place, the story doesn't work. The myth just doesn't work. Like I said, the two communities were living separate but kind of parallel realities, parallel lives. Both of them were states in the making. Palestinians were hoping to have an Arab state be established and recognized, and the Jews were hoping, the Zionists were hoping to have a Jewish state recognized. And they had institutions of state and so on. The one thing, though, that the Zionist community, the Jewish community had, which the Palestinians did not have, was a fighting force, a militia. From very early on, the Zionist leadership invested a lot in indoctrinating and training and arming a militia. And my father, as a young man, volunteered to be, was part of that militia. He was part of the Haganah. Palestinians did not have anything like that. Now, within that year, 1 year period between the end of 47 and the end of 48, something very interesting happened. The Zionist forces managed to conquer almost 80% of the country. They managed to destroy more than 500 towns and villages, including schools and churches and mosques and homes. And they managed to forcibly exile almost 1 million people. And they did all that while they were being attacked from the outside. This doesn't work. Especially since we realize the Palestinians never had a fighting force, never had an army, never had a militia. So it just doesn't work. And it's important to take a look at this picture, this absurd map that was put together by the United Nations, to begin to see how absurd, or what absurd notions they had about the reality in Israel and Palestine. Now, what I did in the book, what I was able to do in the book very successfully and with a lot of help, of course, was to weave in the personal story of my story's family within the context of the state of Israel, and also the story of the two nations. And I mentioned in the book a story that my mother told me, and I can't recall when she told me the story, but I know she told it to me many, many times as I was growing up. Now, my mother was born and raised in Jerusalem. She's still alive. She's 86. She lives there still. And she used to talk about when she was a child, she would walk around the Arab neighborhoods of Jerusalem. Now, we're talking about the new West Jerusalem. And she would see the families, the Palestinian families, sitting under the lemon tree and, you know, on the weekends and so on and so forth. In 1948, she was 22 years old. She had two children. And her husband, my father, was fighting for the Zionist cause. And as the Palestinian communities, these Palestinian neighborhoods in West Jerusalem were evacuated, or the word they use in Hebrew is cleansed or sterilized, which means the Arabs were kicked out, these homes became available. And if anybody's been to Jerusalem, you know these are very distinct homes. They're beautiful, large homes with beautiful gardens. And they're all, by and large, they're all still there. And she was offered one of these homes. As they were made available, they were given to Israeli Jewish families. And she couldn't bring herself to take the home of another mother. And she said, how could I possibly take the home of another mother? How can I move into the home of a family that has been forced into exile and now lives in a refugee camp? And then she would talk about the truckloads that the Israelis, you know, driven by Israelis, full of loot, because these are well-to-do families. These are beautiful homes. They had rugs and they had furniture, and they were all looted. And she felt a sense of shame for these people. She couldn't understand how they were not ashamed to do this. And she also talks about, and I've heard this from other people as well, that when the soldiers came in, when the Zionist forces came in, the coffee was still warm on the table. In other words, the families had just fled. Now, the problem with the story is that it didn't fit the story that I was told. The national narrative, the narrative that I was taught as a boy going to a school in Israel, doesn't fit this. Because the story is that the Arabs left. They attacked us, we won, they left, and we get the spoils. But if that's true, what was wrong with taking a home? Why did she not agree to take the home? Where's the problem? And I remember this troubling me, kind of sitting in the back of my mind for many, many years, and it wasn't until I was actually working on the book that I was able to reconcile this and realize that what she was telling me was that the national narrative is not true. The narrative, the story that we're told, and people are being told this story here too, by candidates for presidency, that the Jewish community was attacked in 47, luckily they won, and so on and so forth, and the Arabs left. Now, this is the general, this is my father, and the story has two parts. It has the general's son, which is a big part of who I am and who I was, and then the other part is the journey of an Israeli in Palestine. The two are connected, but they're two distinct parts. Now, my father, after the war was won, after Israel was created, what we call the War of Independence, Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe, he remained in the military as an officer and had a very distinctive military career. He was the governor of Gaza when it was occupied in 1956, and that was his first interaction with Palestinians. He suddenly realized, once Gaza was occupied after the war in 1956, that he was placed in the position to be the overlord, the occupier of these people, and he had no way to communicate with them. He knew nothing about them. He didn't speak their language. And he, of course, he didn't like that at all. And so he started studying Arabic, and of course, Arabic language and literature became his second career later on. His impression of the people in Gaza was once again completely different than what was told to us as a nation. As Israel was preparing for war, and I talk about this in the book a little bit, about the reasons for this and how the Israeli top brass and the leadership, the Zionist leadership, wanted to begin this war against Egypt. The sense was, the story was, these refugees in Gaza, from whom we took the land, are waiting for an opportunity to slaughter us and take their homes back, because they don't like the fact that we took their land. Now, this was being said by people like Moshe Dayan. This was the narrative. So we have to go in there and make sure that they don't do that. Now, if anybody knows anything about the refugees in Gaza, it's absolutely clear they had no ability to attack anybody. Well, when my father ended his role as being the governor of Gaza, he wrote a very well-known report. It was called the Gaza Report. And he describes the people in Gaza as nothing but willing to and desiring to live in harmony and peace with Israel, just to move on beyond this conflict and get back to normal life. And so again, I was hearing this one story about somebody who was actually there and his impression from the people, and this other story, which was a national narrative. Now, in 1967, as we all know, there's another Middle East war, about 10 years after that. By then, my father was a general. And in the spring of 1967, the drums of war were beating. As some of you may recall, the Egyptian president, Nasser, decided to kick out the peacekeepers from the Sinai Peninsula, which was demilitarized and kept the two countries apart, and allow his forces to go into the Sinai Peninsula. And he also threatened to close the Straits of Tiran, which would not allow Israeli ships to go up to the port city of Eilat. So the Israeli army, the Israeli generals said this was a reason for war, and they wanted to begin a war. Now, a lot has been written and a lot has been said, and many movies have been made about this period between the spring of 1967 and the summer in June when the war actually began. And it's a fascinating story, because the generals wanted war, which is not surprising. They saw an opportunity for war and they wanted the war. The Israeli cabinet, however, was very hesitant. And when we look at these two groups, it's very, very interesting. They're two completely, entirely different groups of people. The cabinet members were older, they were in their mid to late 60s. They were all, most of them were born in exile, they had suffered the pogroms. The Holocaust was only 25 years behind them. And they were fearful and they were cautious and they were not at all excited about the possibility of war. The generals were in their early to mid 40s. Almost all of them were born in Palestine. Almost all of them were part of the Zionist militia before the state was created. And they were this new Jew that the Zionists wanted to create, this wonderful creation full of testosterone that was ready to fight, and they're very assertive. And the relationship between these two groups was very interesting, and there was a real tug of war, a serious, very strong tug of war between them, until finally the government succumbed and gave the okay for the army to begin a preemptive strike against Egypt. Now, as I was working on the book, I chose to go and take a look at the Israeli Army archives to learn more about my father's career. And one of the things I wanted to see was, in particular, was the minutes of the meetings of the generals leading up to the 1967 war. And again, a great deal has been written about it, and I thought I read everything, and wasn't expecting any surprises. Yet as I was reading the minutes of these meetings, particularly the meetings between the top brass of the army and the cabinet, my father said something, and then some of the other generals repeated it. And what they said was that the Egyptian army was not prepared for war, and therefore we have an opportunity to destroy them quite easily. In other words, they needed at least a year and a half to 2 years before they would be ready for war. So we have an opportunity to attack and destroy them. Now, what is the story? What is the story that we hear about the 1967 war? Israel was once again attacked by Arab armies intent on destroying it. And once again, miraculously, because they were motivated and because they were smart, and now we hear that they were culturally somehow, advanced or something. And by the grace of God, they not only defeated their enemies, but they conquered all this land and so on. Once again, this myth doesn't fit in with the story of what actually took place. They're talking, not talking about an existential threat, they're talking about an opportunity. They're saying that the fact that the Egyptians brought their army closer to Israel was an advantage to Israel and made it easier to destroy the Egyptian army. Nothing, by the way, about the Jordanians or about the Syrians. So the cabinet gave the okay, and the Israeli army went and defeated, destroyed the Egyptian army, conquered the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip once again in a matter of days. Now, one issue that was left unfinished, considered unfinished business by the generals in particular, was the issue of the West Bank. When the war of 1948 ended, the West Bank was not in the hands of Israel. And the Israeli commanders, the army commanders, were very upset about that because they believed Israel had the military capability of taking that piece of land way back in 48, but for political reason, Israel decided not to pursue that. They had pushed for years and years and years for war that would allow Israel to take the West Bank so that Israel's eastern boundary would be the Jordan River. Well, here was an opportunity. They're already in the motions of war. The war was already taking place. It would be nothing for them to take the West Bank. So the generals, along with Moshe Dayan, who was Minister of Defense, without cabinet approval, took the West Bank and then took the Golan Heights, which was a piece of land that Israel had wanted for many, many years because it has water resources and so on. So, once again, let's take a look at what happened. It all ended in 6 days. What happened in those 6 days? Israel destroyed three Arab armies, conquered the West Bank, conquered the Golan Heights, conquered the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip, killed over 15,000 Arab soldiers at a loss of 700 soldiers, and we're told that they were attacked by massive armies intending to destroy it, and they did all this. So once again, as we look at the myth, and we look at the reality, we see that it just doesn't work. And then as we look again, we see that there's a common thread here. And the common thread is painting Israel as this small David fighting this massive Goliath, and just through sheer luck or the grace of God or whoever it might be, being able to prevail and conquer and prevail and conquer. Now, my father did something very interesting. At the end of the war, at the very first meeting of the general staff after the war, he got up and he said, "We now have an opportunity to solve the Palestinian problem. Let's allow the Palestinians to establish a state in the West Bank and Gaza." This makes sense in terms of the partition plan, because the partition plan initially wanted to provide for both nations who share that land. Now Israel was in a much better position. And he said, if we want to maintain a Jewish democracy, we can't be occupying millions of Arabs. We're either not going to be Jewish or we're not going to be a democracy. This is not what we fought for. But in reality, what took place is, immediately as the war was over, within days, a massive settlement project began in East Jerusalem and in the West Bank. These are all the generals. This is the victory picture. With the president of the State of Israel, Zalman Shazar, who was, representing that other generation. He wasn't really a cabinet member. The president is kind of a symbolic position. But here he is, with all these wonderful young new Zionist Jews that had delivered the land of Israel to the Jewish people, finally after 2,000 years. And this only after 25 years after the Holocaust. From a Jewish perspective, from a Zionist historical perspective, this is unprecedented. We're finally back. And this generation of these generals was termed by one Hebrew poet as the silver tray upon which the land of Israel was presented back to the Jewish people. In reality, this is what took place. Over a 20 to 25 year period, Palestine was erased and Israel took its place. The ethnic cleansing that took place in 1947 began at the end of 1947, 1948. It goes on to this day. It's not only a matter of taking the land. It's not only a matter of expelling the population. It's also a matter of de-Arabizing the country. This country that has had 1,500 years of Arab history, Arab and Muslim history. So it means destroying monuments. It means either destroying or allowing to stay in disrepair until they crumble to the ground. It means changing the names of the place of places. It means rewriting a history and completely ignoring this other reality. The problem, of course, is that the Arabs won't go and the culture won't go. So what do we do? Israel has. And this again goes back to when people talk about the West Bank as a possible Palestinian state today. And maybe perhaps there could be some kind of resolution where Israel and the Palestinians agree on this kind of a two-state solution. The reason this is a misunderstanding is this. If we take a look at what Israel did in 1948 and then immediately after the war, and we take a look at what Israel did in 1967 and immediately after that war, it's clear that it's the exact same thing. One is the continuation of the other. In other words, ethnically cleansing, getting rid of the people, taking their land, and investing heavily in building cities and towns and highways and so on for Israeli Jews only. This took place after 1948 in all of Palestine, and then it went on and did the exact same thing. Israel did the exact same thing in the West Bank after that. One is a continuation of another. There's no pause here. After the 1967 war, Israel did everything it could so that conquest would be irreversible. And they succeeded. And the name of the game is de-Arabizing the country. If you've been to Jerusalem, if you've been to the old city of Jerusalem, you may have seen right outside the Jewish quarter is a community called Silwan. Silwan sits in the valley, right outside of where the Wailing Wall is and so on. It's a community of 50,000 people. Now somebody decided that under Silwan sits the original city of King David. Never mind the fact that there is no historical proof that a King David ever existed. But there's a massive process of ethnic cleansing, destruction of homes, taking place in Silwan right now, and a massive park called the the city of David that's being built by Israel. 50,000 people have to be kicked out of their homes and their community destroyed to do what? To somehow create a mythical connection between today's Israel and biblical Israel of the days of King David, the glory of King David. Completely mythical. And when you stand there and if you look, you see the Jewish quarter on the hill, and then you see Silwan on the bottom, and you can see how somebody envisioned this grand Jewish mythological park, completely erasing the Arab nature of the land, of Jerusalem. And this is going on, Silwan is one example, it goes on in countless places. But this is a process that it's important to understand. Erasing Palestine, de-Arabizing the land, is a big part of the Zionist mission. I would say it defines the Zionist mission. And therefore there has not been any compromise, and there will be a compromise on the issue of the land.
That was Mikko Pellet, recorded by Jeff Blankford on September 19, 2012. Mikko Pellet was born into a family of Zionist Jews in Jerusalem. A son of one of the founding fathers of Israel, he could have become a military or political leader. Instead, he questioned his schooling and the official story of Israel. Mikko Pellet presented his first book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, in Berkeley, California, at a benefit for clean water for children in Gaza, organized by the Middle East Children's Alliance. Come back for part two of Mikko Pellet's talk, where he describes an event that could have made him give up all his efforts for reconciliation. It was the death of his 13-year-old niece, Smadar, in a suicide bombing. He describes the extraordinary position his sister Nurit took when the world media were focused on her, the bereaved mother. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, TUCRadio.org. That's TUCRadio.org. Look under newest programs. Please have a pen handy to write down a phone number to call to find out how to order the 1-hour speech by Mikko Pellet on The General's Son as audio CD. You can get information on how to order by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654. For information on how to order, you can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.